Welcome to the L.A. Spill Show. I'm Bill, and tonight we're going to talk about Eric Fromm's The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness. I've talked about this before. I've done a number of shows, several shows on this, but there's a segment I was reading recently that I felt was quite rather important to read. I'll do it here in a second. The part I'm going to read tonight is the existential needs of man and the various character-rooted passions. It's a fascinating concept, fascinating thing. And another section is effectiveness, is that I'm going to read. Hopefully, I think I can get through most of this tonight, I'm hoping. But this is so, this book is fascinating. And if anybody can get it, it's called The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness by Eric Fromm. And it's so, I can't explain it actually, other than to say that it encompasses the entire magnitude of mankind's psychology, you know, makeup, and it's so right in so many ways, and so observant, and yet leaves room for the imagination as well, and the spiritual aspect of man. And but the existential needs of man, the various character-rooted passions, I thought was great, and the frame of orientation and devotion. And I'm going to start with this. On page 230 of this book, it states, man's capacity for self-awareness, reason, and imagination, new qualities that go beyond the capacity for instrumental thinking of even the cleverest animals, requires a picture of the world and of his place in it that is structured and has inner cohesion. Man needs a map of his natural and social world without which he would be confused and unable to act purposefully and consistently. He would have no way of orientating himself and or finding for himself a fixed point that permits him to organize all the impressions that impinge upon him. Whether he believes in sorcery and magic as final explanations of all events, or in the spirit of his ancestors as guiding his life and fate, or in an omnipotent God who will reward or punish him, or in the power of science to give answers to all human problems, from the standpoint of his need for a frame of orientation, it does not make any difference. His world makes sense to him, and he feels certain about his ideas through the consensus with those around him. And even if the map is wrong, it fulfills its psychological function. But the map was never entirely wrong, nor has it ever been entirely right either. It has always been enough of an approximation to the explanation of phenomena to serve the purpose of living. And I think that's a profound, profound paragraph. And I, you know, the impressive fact is that we do not find any culture in which there does not exist such a frame of orientation, or any individual either. Often an individual can disclaim having any such overall picture and believe that he responds to the various phenomena. The various phenomena and incidents of life from case to case as his judgment guides him. But it can be easily demonstrated that he takes his own philosophy for granted, because to him it is only common sense, and he is unaware that all his concepts rest upon a commonly accepted frame of reference. When such a person is confronted with a fundamentally different total view of life, he judges it as crazy, or irrational, or childish. while he considers himself as the being, as being only logical. The need for the formation of a frame of reference is particularly clear in the case of children. They show at a certain age a deep need for a frame of orientation and often make it up themselves in an ingenious way using the few data available to them. The intensity of the need for a frame of orientation explains a fact that has puzzled many students of man, namely the ease with which people fall under the spell of irrational doctrines, either political or religious or of any other nature, when to the one who is not under their influence, it seems obvious that they are worthless constructs. Part of the answer lies in the suggestive influence of leaders and the suggestibility of a man. But this does not seem to be the whole story. Man would probably not be so suggestive were it not that his need for a cohesive frame of orientation is so vital. The more an ideology pretends to give answers to all questions, the more attractive it is. Here may lie the reason why irrational or even plainly insane thought systems can so easily attract the minds of men. I have come across so many crazy concepts in my life, some of them seeming valid until you research them further, and then some extremely valid. But at the same time, I can't deny the fact that I myself need a higher authority. That's what we all search for. That's the fascinating thing about this segment of the book and how it explains this. And we all need that. We all seek that higher authority, whether it's our own, whatever it is. But let me go on. But a map is not enough as a guide for action. Man also needs a goal. It tells him where to go. The animal has no such problems. It is its instincts provide it with a map as well as with goals. But man, lacking instinctive determination and having a brain that permits him to think of many directions in which he could go, needs an object of ultimate concern. To use Tillich's expression, he needs an object of devotion to be the focal point of all his strivings and the basis for all his effective and not only proclaimed values. He needs such an object of devotion for a number of reasons. The objects integrate his energies in one direction. It elevates him beyond his isolated existence with all its doubts and insecurity and gives meaning to life. In being devoted to the goal beyond his isolated ego, he transcends himself and leaves the prison of absolute egocentricity. The object of man's devotion varies. He can be devoted to an idol. Which requires him to kill his children or to an ideal that makes him protect children. He can be devoted to the growth of life or to its destruction. He can be devoted to the goal of amassing a fortune, of acquiring power, of destruction, or to that of loving and being productive and courageous. He can be devoted to the most divisive goals and idols. Yet while the difference in the objects of devotion are of immense importance, the need for devotion itself is a primary existential need demanding fulfillment regardless of how this need is fulfilled. Man, I gotta tell you, if that doesn't throw you for a loop, I don't know what else. The fact that all men and women, I mean, it's just men is a generic term, need this higher thought, need this goal to achieve whatever it is they set to achieve. It makes so much sense to me because it's so real as to how we operate as a species and how we give our devotion God or to money or to a state, you know, or to a spouse or to some screen idol or whatever it may be, or saint or, you know, whoever or whatever it may be. But we have this need to do so. And whether we, you know, whoever we give it to is our own thing, you know. So I guess in essence, what I'm saying is that I identify with that so well, because in so many ways I need to believe that there's a higher intelligence than myself, okay, or a higher intelligence than Einstein, you know what I mean, or whoever it may be, some human thing, you know, some whatever human derived concept. Because if I don't believe in that, then I might as well give up now. Might as well give up now. All right. So, and this goes on. And let me explain. Rootedness. When an infant is born, he leaves the security of the womb, the situation in which he was still part of nature, where he lived through his mother's body. At the moment of birth, he is still symbiotically attached to mother. And even after birth, he remains so longer than most other animals. The most complete separation is, the greater the need to replace your original biological roots by new affective roots. Yet there remains a deep craving not to sever the original ties, or a deep craving to find a new situation of absolute protection and security to return to the lost paradise. But the way to paradise is blocked by man's biological, and particularly by his neurophysiological constitution. He has only one alternative, either to persist in his craving to regress, and to pay for it by symbolic dependence on mother and on symbolic substitutes such as soil, nature, God, nature, the nation, or a bureaucracy, or to progress and find new roots in the world by his own efforts, by experiencing the brotherhood of man, by freeing himself from the power of the past. Man, aware of his separateness, needs to find new ties, and his fellow man, his very sanity depends on it. Without strong, effective ties to the world, he would suffer from utter isolation and lostness. But he can relate himself to others in different and ascertainable ways. He can love others, which requires the presence of independence and productiveness. Or, if his sense of freedom is not developed, he can relate to others symbiotically by becoming part of them, or by making them part of himself. In this symbiotic relationship, he strives either to control others, which is sadism, or to be controlled by them, which is masochism. If he cannot choose either the way of love or the way of symbiosis, he can solve the problem by relating exclusively to himself, which is narcissism. Then he becomes the world, and loves the world by loving himself. This is a frequent form of dealing with the need for relatedness, usually blended with sadism. But it is a dangerous one. In its extreme form, it leads to some form of madness. At last, the malignant form of solving the problem, usually blended with extreme narcissism, is the craving to destroy all others. If no one exists outside of me, I need not fear others, nor need I relate myself to them. By destroying the world, I am saved from being crushed by it. and therefore you have these grand dictators who reach the power and, you know, destroy worlds. Unity. The existential split in man would be unbearable could he not establish a sense of unity within himself and with the natural and human world outside. But there are many ways of reestablishing unity. Man can anesthetize his consciousness by inducing states of trance or ecstasy, meditated by such means as drugs or sexual orgies, fasting, dancing, and other rituals that abound in various cults. He can also try to identify himself with the animal in order to regain the lost harmony. This form of seeking unity is the essence of the many primitive religions in which the ancestor of the tribe is a totem animal, or in which man identifies with the animal by acting like one. For instance, the Teutonic berserkers, who identify themselves with a bear, or by wearing an animal mask. Unity can also be established by subordinating all energies to one all-consuming passion, such as the passion for destruction, power, fame, or property. To forget oneself in the sense of anesthetizing one's reason is the aim of all these attempts to restore unity within oneself. It is a tragic attempt. It is the sense that either it succeeds only momentarily, as in a trance or in drunkenness, or even if it is permanent, as in passion for hate or power. It cripples man, estranges him from others, twists his judgment, and makes him as dependent on his particular passion as another is on hard drugs. There is only one approach to unity that can be successful without crippling man. Such an attempt was made in the first millennium BC in all parts of the world where man was developed, where man had developed a civilization, in China and in India, in Egypt, in Palestine, in Greece. The great religions springing from the soil of these cultures taught the man that man can achieve unity not by a tragic effort to undo the fact of the split, but by fully developing human reason and love. Great as are the differences between Taoism, or Taoism rather, Buddhism, prophetic Judaism, and the Christianity of the Gospels, these religions had one common goal: to arrive at the experience of oneness, not by regressing to animal existence, but by becoming fully human, oneness within man, oneness between man and nature, the oneness between man and other men. In a short historical time of 25 years, man does not seem to have made much progress in achieving the goal that was postulated by these religions. The inevitable slowness of man's economic and social development, plus the fact that the religions were co-opted by those whose social function it was to rule and manipulate men, seemed to account for this. Yet the new concept of unity was as revolutionary an event as man's psychical development, as an invention of agriculture and industry was for the economic development. Nor was this concept ever totally lost. It was brought to life in the Christian sects, among the mystics of all religions, in the ideas of Joachim de Fuori, among the Renaissance humanists, and in a secular form in the philosophy of Marx. The alternative between regressive and progressive ways of achieving salvation is not only a social historical one. Each individual is confronted confronted with the same alternative, his margin of freedom not to choose the regressive solution to a society that has chosen it is indeed small, yet it exists. But great effort, great thinking and guidance by the teaching of the great humanists is necessary. Neurosis can be understood best as the battle between these two tendencies within an individual. Hence, deep character analysis leads, if successful, to the life-affirming solution. Another solution to man's existential split problem is quite characteristic of a contemporary cybernetic society. To be identified with one's social role, to feel little, to lose oneself by reducing oneself to a thing. Your essential split is camouflaged because man becomes identified with his social organization and forgets that he is a person. He becomes, to use Heidegger's term, a non-person. He is, we might say, in a negative ecstasis. He forgets himself by ceasing to be he, by ceasing to be a person and becoming a thing. That's fascinating. This section, this next section, it just knocked me out when I read it because it's so real. It's so real. As what we are as human beings. What drives our lives. And it's called effectiveness. Man's awareness of himself as being in a strange and overpowering world and his consequent sense of impotence could easily overwhelm him. If he experienced himself as entirely passive, a mere object, he would lack a sense of his own will, of his identity. To compensate for this, he must acquire a sense of being able to do something, to move somebody, to make a dent, or to use the most adequate English word to be effective. We use the word today in referring to an effective speaker or salesman, meaning one who succeeds in getting results. But this is a deterioration of the original meaning of to effect, from the Latin ex facere, meaning to do. To effect is the equivalent of to bring to pass, to accomplish, to realize, to carry out, to fulfill. An effective person is one who has the capacity to do, to effect, or to accomplish something. To be able to effect something is the assertion that one is not impotent, but that one is an alive, functioning human being. To be able to effect, means to be active and not only to be affected, to be active and not only passive. It is, in the last analysis, the proof that one is. The principle can be formulated thus: I am because I effect. That's powerful. That's a very, very powerful concept. Okay? We are because we effect. We have, all of us, to no matter who we are, have an effect on somebody else or on something or on nature or whatever it may be. If you're a parent, you have an effect on your children. If you're a teacher, you have an effect on your students. If you're a doctor, you have an effect on your patients. You know, if you're a government official, you have an effect on those who you govern. These are all part and parcel of who we are as individuals, because in order to be alive and human, we must effect somebody, something. We must make a difference in this world, which plays on our karmic existence. Like, you know, it's known by so many religions and by so many people individually that we are a karmic creation. We are here to fulfill our karmic destiny, whatever that may be, whatever we came here to achieve. We came back to fulfill ourselves, to fulfill our destinies, either good or bad. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's either light or dark. And those people will follow the dark as rapidly as they'll follow the light, some people. And with validation, with so understanding that mankind is a duopoly, duopoly. We are a split personality. We are bipolar in our understanding that you have so many positive, so many negative effects within your genetic makeup, right? So these are the elements that we must live within to affect a world around us, whether good or bad, is part of our karmic makeup. We hope that we are in a final stage. I hope that everybody listening tonight is in a final stage of unity consciousness. We are entering this period now. March 9th is the ninth wave, and on October 28th, we are entering the Aquarian period, the Aquarian age, so that all negativity, all disappointment, all hatred, all the negative that we exist will wipe away from us and will become greater and the more noble characters, much more noble species, right, in the universe, and take our place amongst the councils and so on. Because we have suffered through the ages and understand what third dimensional existence means, right, in the sense that we have experienced it, even though we are spirit, even though we are spirits having a physical or human experience, we will go on from here. We will go on and on and on and on and on for eternity, because that's what we are. Okay? This is simply a quantum leap into the third dimension. So in order to pick up a few more or a few less karmic influences, so that by the time we leave the third dimension, we enter the fourth and fifth dimensions unburdened by our physical natures, okay, if you will. And that's essential. That's essential to our adaptation, or our adaptation to the future. That we must leave the past. We must expunge the past from our lives, all right, and move on to the future, all right, remembering only that thin line between the two, the border between the first and the fifth dimensions, okay, they're all there. We have to backtrack through them all in order to become sane. Yeah, I speak to you now through the auspices of the spirit that, led me to this, right? Led me to this finding. But at the same time, understanding the incredible insights that Eric Fromm wrote here, okay, regarding the human mentality, the human spirit, okay? The picture of a starving child, but a number of investigations have stressed this point. At the beginning of this century, Kay Groos, the classic interpreter of play, wrote that an essential motive in the play, Child's Play, was the joy in being a cause. This was his explanation of the child's pleasure in making a clatter, moving things around and playing in puddles and similar activities. His and knowledge of the effects and to be ourselves the producer of these effects. A similar idea was expressed 50 years later by J. Paget, who observed the children's special interest in the objects that he affects by his own movements. R.W. writes, White, rather, used a similar concept in describing one of the basic motivations in man as competitive motivation, and the proposed and word effectance for the motivation acceptance aspect of the competence. The same need is manifested in the fact that the first real sentence of some children from about the age of 15 to 18 months is some version of I do, repeated, and then also for the first time, me, and often used before mine. And due to his biological situation, the child is necessarily in a state of extraordinary helplessness up to the age of 18 months, and even later he is largely dependent on the favors of the goodwill of others. The degree of the child's natural powerlessness changes every day. While in general, adults are much slower in changing their attitude toward the child. The child's tantrum, his crying, his stubbornness, different ways in which he tries to battle adults, are among the most visible manifestations of his attempt to make an effect by the superior strength of the adults. With defeat does not remain without consequences. It would seem to activate a tendency to overcome the defeat by doing actively what one was forced to mention publicly. Yeah. The adult too feels the need to reassure people that he is by means able to affect the ways to achieve a sense of effecting as manifold by the clothing in the expression of satisfaction, the baby being nursed, a smile from the loved person, sexual response from the lower interest from the pattern and conservation, by work, material, intellectual, artistic, but the experiencing their fear by the murderers watching the anguish in the face of fear of conquering a country, by torturing people, by seeing destruction of what has been constructed, the need to effect compresses itself in a personal relation and as well as the relationship to animals, to inanimate nature, and to ideas in the relationship to others. The fundamental alternative is to feel either the potency to affect love or to affect fear and suffering. In the relationship to strings, the ultimate alternative is being constructed and criticized. Opposite is their alternatives are. These are responses to the same essential need to effect. In studying depression and boredom, one can find material to show that a sense of being compromised to effect. The complete vital impotence of such sexual impotence is only a small part. It's one of the most painful and most tolerated experiences a man can do almost anything to would do almost anything to overcome it, from drugs and work addiction to cruelty and murder. Excitation and stimulation. The Russian neurologist Ivan Sekhanov was the first to establish in reflex of the brain that the nervous system has the need to be exercised to experience a certain minimum of excitation. R.B. Livingston says the same principle. The nervous system is a source for activity as well as integration. The brain is not merely reactive to similar stimuli. It is self spontaneously active. Brain cell actively begins to embryonic life and perhaps constitutes the organization of normal development. Brain development occurs most rapidly prior to birth, and for a few reasons thereafter. Following this period of exuberant growth, the rate of development decreased markedly. Yet even in the adult, there was no point beyond which to develop cases, beyond which the capacities for reorganization following disease or occur or injury disappear. The news is so fabricated, it's so prefabricated that we don't even know what's real and not real anymore. So we have to use our intuition and say that because we are bombarded or we are loaded with those chemtrails and jet trails and whatever we have out there, we are ourselves responsible for that nightmare, all right? And the reason for that is because all of these kids want to get out early. They don't want to do anything and they don't want to be anything. Or if they do, they don't know what they're going to be. They're going to be students. Right? So, I wish you both well. I wish everyone well. I hope that maybe I'll get a chance to see you next month or so. But that homework has to be collected. Collect it tomorrow. Right? So, let's wait for the bell. I want to go through this next section to talk about excitation and stimulation. And it's fascinating because that's what we are. We are stimulation. We need audio. We need visual. We need sensory. We need water. We need oil. We need gas. We need coal. We need all of these energies. Sources that come from the Earth's surface or beneath the Earth. These are all, this is our conduit, our mouth, our nose, our spiritual body, the conduit to the 17th century, 18th century, and all this compiled in the 1800s. The thoughts of revolution were rampant, and why? Should we be able to topple those unions because of poor bargaining, because of these major concessions, because of not asking the rank and file to vote on appraisal? This is what's happened. And, we have to say damn those who, censor our lives. The Russian neurologist, Ivan Shekhov, was the first to establish the reflexes of the brain, that the nervous system has the need to be exercised to experience a certain minimum of excitation. R.B. Livingston stated that the same principle, the nervous system is a source of activity as well as integration. The brain is not merely reactive to outside influence, it itself spontaneously active. brain cell activity begins in embryonic life and probably contributes to organizational development. Brain development occurs most rapidly prior to birth and for a few moments or a few months thereafter. Following this period of exuberant growth, the rate of development decreases markedly. Yet even in the adult, there is no point beyond which development ceases, beyond which the capacity for reorganization following disease or injury disappear. Further on, the brain consumes oxygen at a rate comparable to that of active muscle. Active muscle can sustain such a rate of oxygen consumption for only a short period, but the nervous system continues its high rate for a long time, awake or to sleep from birth until death. Okay? And, let's see. After the tissue culture, nerve cells continue to be biologically and electrically active. One idea in which we need for constant excitation of the brain can be recognized is the phenomenon of dreaming. It is well established that a considerable proportion of our sleeping time, about 25%, spent in dreaming. The difference between individual is not whether or not they dream, but whether or not they remember their dreams. And the individuals appear to show semi-pathological reactions if they are preventing from dreaming. It is a relevant question why the brain, comprising only 2% of the body weight, is the only organ, aside from the heart and lungs, that remains active during sleep, while the rest of the body is in a state of rest, or to put it in a neuropsychological term, why the brain uses 20% of the body's total intake of oxygen day and night. It would seem that this means the neuron ought to be a state of greater activity than the cell in other parts of the body. As to the reason for this, one could speculate that sufficient oxygen supply to the brain is of such vital importance to living that the brain is provided with extra margin of activity and excitation. The infant's need for stimulation has been demonstrated by the many investigators. R. Spitz has shown the pathological effects of children of stimulants on infants. The Harlows and others have demonstrated that early deprivation of contact with mother results in severe psychic damage to monkeys. The same problem has been studied by D.E. Schechter in pyramid, or rather in pursuit of this thesis. The social stimulation constitutes a basis for the child's development. He arrives at the conclusion that without adequate social, including perceptual stimulation. As for instance, in blind and institutionalized infants, deficits develop in emotional and social relationships, in language, abstract thinking, and inner control. Experimental studies have also demonstrated the need for stimulation and excitement. Dober versus Dober, Kofler demonstrated the autarkic nitrogenous reaction. Let's see. What's my place here? Magnus reactants to movement in stillborns. Wolf and White, 1965, observed several pursuits, visual pursuit of objects with conjugate eye movements in three of the 4 day olds. Franz described one prolonged visual experiment, a fixation on more complex visual patterns, as against similar ones during the early weeks of the station. D.E. Schechter adds, of course, we cannot know the quality of the infant subjective perceptual experience, but only the fact of the discriminating visual motor response. Only in a noose manner of speaking, can we conclude that infants prefer complex stimulus patterns. The experiment's ongoing sensory deprivation at McGill have shown that the elimination of most outside stimulus, even when accompanied by the satisfaction of all psychological needs,
to respond to actively and sympathetically
attain the discover ever new aspects of power, objects which cease to be a mere object. By becoming more awake and more aware, you do not remain the passive object upon which the stimuli acts, to whose melody your body has to dance, as it were. Instead, you express your own faculties by being related to the world. You become active and productive. The simple stimuli produces a strive in. The person is driven by it. Activating stimuli result in the striving. The person is actually striving for a goal. The difference between two kinds of stimuli and the responses are very have very important consequences. Failure of the first, second kind, repeated beyond a certain threshold of those volumes. Whoa. All right. So we get a few more minutes. The significance of activating a simple stimuli is crucial for the problem of learning. If learning means to penetrate from the surface or of phenomena to its root, i.e. to their causes, for deceptive ideologies to the naked facts, this approximating the truth, it is an exhilarating active process and condition for human growth. I do not refer here only to booking lunatics, but to the discovery a child or an illiterate member of a primitive tribe is merely the acquisition of a political information mediated by the conditioning. We are simply with a simple stimulus in which the person is acted upon by a stimulation of this need for praise, security, success, and so forth. Contemporary life is in industrial societies operates around entirely with such simple stimuli, which is stimulated at such drives as sexual desires, greed, sadism, destructiveness, narcissism. These stimuli are mediated through movies, television, radio, news magazines, newspapers, and the commodity market. On the whole, advertising rests upon the stimulation of socially produced desires. The mechanism itself is the same. Simple situation, immediate and passive response. There lies the reason why the stimuli have to be changed constantly, or at least they become ineffective. A car that is exciting today will be boring in a year or two. So much will be changed in the search for excitation. A place one knows well automatically becomes boring, so that excitement can be had her own by visiting website places as many as possible in one trip. Such a framework, sexual partners also need to be changed in order to produce exaltation. We have about 4 minutes remaining, and nobody's called in. Welcome to take calls tonight if you want to call. The description given so far needs to be qualified by stressing that it is not only the stimulus that counts. The only stimulating poem or persons will fail completely with something who is inescapable of responding because of his own fear, inhibition, laziness, passivity. The activating stimuli requires a touchable stimuli in order to have an effect. Touchable not in the sense of being educated, but of being humanly responsive. other hand, the person who is fully aware does not necessarily need any particular outside stimulus to be active. In fact, he creates his own stimuli. The defense can be clearly seen in children. Up to a certain age, around the 5 years, they are so acute and productive that they make their own stimuli. They create a whole world out of scraps of paper, wood, stones, chairs, particularly anything they find available. But when, after the chairs of six, the age of six, they become docile, unexplainable, extemporaneous, and passive, they want to be situated in such a way that they can remain passive and only reactive. Remain elaborate toys. They can remain passive and only react. They want elaborate toys that they can remain passive. They want elaborate toys. Get bored with them after a short while. In brief, they already behave as the elders do their cars, clothes, places to travel, and lovers. There is another important difference between simple and activated status. The person who is driving by the simple stimulus status, ask me where the farm bill was, and I left it up there and added the piece woman. I believe there's one can formulate a base based on neurophysiological and psychological data in reference to the difference between the two types of stimuli. The most reflexive stimuli is the most frequently. It must be a change in intensity and or kind, and more activating it is, the longer it retains its stimulating quality, the less necessary is a change in intensity and common causes. I have dealt at such length the organism needs to stimulation and excitation. Easier to get excited by anger, rage, and cruelty, or the passion of destroy, than by love and productiveness and active interest. That first kind of excitation does not require the individual to make an effort. One does not need to have patience and discipline to learn to concentrate, to endure frustration, and do practical, critical thinking to overcome one's narcissism and greed. If the person has failed to grow, simple stimuli are always at hand and can always be produced. Such stimuli is accident, fires, crimes, or wars can be read about in the newspapers, heard about in radio reports, or watched on television and movies. People can also produce them in their own minds by finding reasons to hate, to destroy, and to control others. The strength of this Krovay is indicated by the millions of people, dollars, the mass media made by selling the kind of excitation. In fact, many married couples stay together for this reason. The marriage gives them the opportunity to experience hate, quarrels, sadism, and submission. The stay, however, does not in spite of their fights, but because of them. Masochistic behavior, the pleasure and suffering, or submitting, as one of the roots in this need for excitement. Masochistic persons that they can react when the stimuli overpowers them, as it were, when they can give themselves up to the excitement forced upon them. I'm going to stop at that. The show is done. We're now streaming. We stopped streaming. But I just wanted to mention that I hope you got something out of this. This is from Eric Fromm, The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness. A fascinating, fascinating book. And highly, highly recommend that you seek it out. And with that, I'm going to end the show. And I hope you had a wonderful week. And join us next week, Tuesday night. And have a pleasant evening. Good night.